Finance come to order. It is 8:41. We have Representative Wilson, we have Vice Chair Newman, Stoltz, Representative Guerra, Representative Dettenberg, and Representative Costello. We have a bare quorum to conduct business. We have the two bills before us, House Bill 361 and House Bill 89. Oh, and I forgot, Representative Seaton, your cell phone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, it's okay. He turned it off. Don't bother calling him. I was trying to get a free box of donuts. He is much smarter than the rest of us. The first thing he did was turned it off. So our best laid plans to get a box of donuts were allayed by the cagey Homerite. We have Representative Sadler. Present your bill.
Make sure I turn my cell phone off too.
I thought I had that so well planned. And we've been joined by Representative Newman, Representative Edgman, and Representative Thompson. We have not a full committee, but we are not on the edge of a quorum anymore.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12. I appreciate very much you hearing House Bill 361 this morning. Briefly, autism is a significant and growing problem in Alaska. Applying the national rates of incidence to the 2010 census in Alaska, about 2% of Alaska children are born with this developmental disability, characterized by diminished ability to communicate, social isolation, and other symptoms. While it's not curable, autism is treatable. Scientific studies have shown that early intervention, intensive intervention, applied by Applied Behavioral Analysis, or ABA, offers the best opportunity for people with autism to improve their ability to function productively in society. Excuse me. ABA is recognized as the basis of the most effective form of autism treatment by the U.S. Surgeon General, the National Institute of Child Health, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. ABA is best understood as behavior modification, simply. It assesses the relationship between the environment of an individual and their behavior, and then arranges that environment and interactions between the person and that environment to encourage the desired behavior, usually more socially acceptable behavior. 40 years of research now have shown that nearly half of the people with autism who receive early intervention and treatment do not require lifelong support and services, and another half can achieve normal functioning after 2 and 3 years, and I know that's done great things for my son, Danny. This can mean lifetime savings to the state of between $200,000 or $1 million per person, money not spent on institutional care, incarceration, emergency intervention, and not lost to lost productivity. An essential element of successful autism treatment is well-trained behavioral therapists, and the gold standard in this regard is the nationally recognized credential of the Board Certified Behavioral Analyst, or BCBA. Now, to receive the BCBA certification, applicants need a minimum of a master's degree, plus extensive training and passage of the challenging BCBA certification examination. And there's also a board-certified assistant behavior analyst, or BCABA, which a credential has slightly lower qualification standards. Now, the state of Alaska already supports the training of BCBAs through a grant to the Center for Human Development at the University of Alaska Anchorage. There are between 20 and 30 BCBAs and BCABAs in Alaska today. Because they're not formally licensed, however, Alaskans with BCBAs cannot bill health insurance or Medicaid for their services at a rate that reflects their high degree of training and professional skill. This bill, House Bill 361, addresses this situation by providing for those holding the BCBA or BCAB credentials in Alaska to be licensed not by a professional board, but by the Division of Professional Licensing in the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. By ensuring licensing and higher standards of practice for BCBAs, House Bill 361 will encourage more people to provide autism services in Alaska, offer higher reimbursement rates for professional services, protect the public by establishing a high standards of professional practice, provide better outcomes for Alaska children with autism, save the state money by avoiding the cost of institutional care, and improve the quality of life for hundreds of Alaskans and their families. I appreciate your attention. I do have several folks online to testify on this who can answer detailed questions you might have, or I'll be glad to answer your questions as well. Thank you very much.
Short round of general questions for Representative Sadler. All right. Representative Newman.
I think it looks like a good bill, and I'm interested in hearing more about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to thank you for bringing this forward, and I do have a question. We had a bill right here, I think, just yesterday, right in the same section. Are they automatically going to slide into an existing commission or so I'm looking for the other board. Word I can't find. Board, thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, no, there is not currently a board of professional of behavioral analysts.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. There's only 39, through the chair, 39 existing BCBAs in Alaska.
Give or take, there's through the chair, Representative Thompson, rough count, about two dozen BCBAs, people who have that national credential. There's a number that are in the pipeline that have gone through this program that we're supporting with a grant through the Center for Human Development. I don't know the actual numbers of the BCABAs, the assistants, so that's kind of why I give a little fudge factor there.
Through the chair, the reason I was asking that is to run a board, it's fairly expensive. What would their license fees be in order to be able to maintain the board's ability to follow up and do all these things?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, fair question, but there's a common assumption that this requires a professional licensing board. That's not the case. It okay. is it's departmental licensed, much like I think mortuary scientists and some other smaller professional groups that are licensed by the department. So there's not associated fees for a professional licensing board. There are some fees that are associated that the members will pay for the licensing. I'm afraid I don't have an assessment of that cost. It's not tremendously significant.
And that answered my question because I was concerned about the cost per licensee. So thank you.
If I could just add for the record also that the BCBAs have been seeking this licensure for a while. They're well aware of the national costs and records. They're willing to, they'll testify that they're willing to accept those costs. And if I could add one little thing is that there is an autism insurance task force which has been working in the interim, and this is one of the recommendations that's likely to come out of that board is to seek licensure at the low-cost, low-impact departmental licensing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, follow-up on Representative Thompson. So being a different type of board, so will no investigations take place with it going underneath this kind of a board? Because that's where, from our understanding, the costs are is because of any investigations. So since you said this was a different type of board than we heard yesterday, will they not have an investigator?
To the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't believe there will be an investigator assigned to them. Investigation work will be done by the Division of Professional Licensing and DCCED. I don't think many professional boards have their own individual investigator. I think maybe real estate does.
But some of them do.
Some of them do? Okay. Oh, apparently we do have somebody from the division, from the Department and Division of Occupational Licensing who could answer some of those more detailed questions.
So, Mr. Chairman, maybe when they come up to give them a little heads up before she comes up, if you just could tell us maybe the difference between what kind of guidance the board we heard about yesterday was and this one, because I know it's the investigators that the investigations that has seemed to turn some of the boards upside down, and if you only have this number of people, I mean, I know they want to do it, and I understand why, but I've studied it a lot as well, but I don't want to end up putting them out of business because now the license is going to cost, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 because of one investigation that has happened. So I appreciate that when the time comes.
And Representative Wilson and Representative Sadler, you're going to get the same scrutiny as any new board because there's an incredible uncertainty amount of the total cost, the revenues, and the whole fiscal analysis and the presumptions and assumptions when you're creating a new board as opposed to extending one where we have experience. And so it's a little tougher sledding because of the direction we're trying to go on board. So, but we wanted to make sure we have a chance for you to sell this. I hope you know some of the hurdles that it's all the members will have those types of concerns and questions. So,
with the
pre-acknowledgement of the virtue of your idea, whatever comfort that is.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, we'll go into the public testimony. I believe most of these people are going to be online, Representative Sadler.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We have started off with Richard Kiefer O'Donnell. And I keep your testimony just a couple of minutes. We have two bills, and I'm going to let, I would like to get out of here at 10 o'clock because we have a bill on the floor that I have a substantive role in.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dr. Richard Keith O'Donnell, and I'm the Associate Director for the Center for Human Development, which is located as part of UAA. And I want to begin by thanking you and the other members of the committee for this opportunity to testify on behalf of passage of this licensing bill. Center for Human Development is a federally funded, what's called a University Center of Excellence on Developmental Disabilities, and our role is to serve the state, the full state of Alaska. Each state has one, at least. While we're located at UAA, we support services and development of workforce capacity for the entire state of Alaska. I'll keep my testimony brief, and what I want to focus on is primarily a little of the backstory associated with how this bill came about. My role developed as a function of work by the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education starting in 2006, where they researched and developed several reports documenting the needs of children and youth with autism and their families, and specifically recommended that the state put conservative energy into the development of autism specialists. As a function of the 2007 report, a stakeholder meeting was held in November of 2008, and I was brought in from the University of Minnesota to help facilitate that meeting. It was made up of about 60 representatives from different state agencies, school districts, the private sector, and most important, families. And the charge was to come up with recommendations as to the competencies of what these autism specialists should look like. And it was pretty much the consensus from that group that CHD move in the direction to establish a BCBA training program. With initial funding from both the trust and general fund, specifically, we had two options, either to attempt to set up a program, a study on our own, or to partner on a collaborative basis with an existing one outside in a way similar to how occupational therapists and speech and language therapists are prepared. We most definitely opted to do that a route because of the high need to get BCBAs on the ground here in Alaska. At that time, there was one BCBA in the state, and she was not practicing. Okay, we have since developed that program, implemented, and we are now in our fifth cohort. Now, cohort are groups of students that work from 2.5 to 3 years with 1,500 clock hours of supervised field experience, working with children and adults with autism and oftentimes significant and challenging behaviors. As Representative Sadler has pointed out, it has been very productive, and we have another 17 that are in the pipeline to sit through their examination within about 15 months. These folks, the group that's already out there, are very much serving the state of Alaska. They're required as a function of support that they get from the program of study to not only pass the examination. So if they do not pass, they have to either retake it or pay back the money that they've received for tuition and or field experience costs, or and also work for a period of at least 2 years here in the state of Alaska. So it doesn't come with any free lunch. In particular, they've been working on multiple levels, private sector, school districts, okay, and the state, and have also been very actively involved with the implementation of the Complex Behavior Collaborative. It's been a very well-received program. It's very cost-effective, and it's one that's we never have problems with our referrals for new students and meeting our capacity for new admissions each year. People are really wanting this advanced degree. As Representative Sadler pointed out, Folks have to have at least a master's, and typically these are individuals with already existing master's in psychology, special education, or social work. And the BCBA, like social work, and the combination of master's, LCSW, a BCBA has the national credential that the earlier discussion associated with how are these individuals monitored, or what if there's a grievance and such. There's a highly defined and well-established structure within the National Credentialing Board associated with...
Mr. Kiefer, could you wrap up?
Yes.
Could you wrap up, please?
Yes, and I was just going to... That is my closure, that there is a mechanism for that on a national level that would result in the loss of credentialing.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Kiefer O'Donnell? Thank you. Next, we'll go to Annette Blanas.
Hi, this is Annette Blanas. I am the project director for the Capacity Building and Autism Interventions Project at the Center for Human Development. I am also on the Autism Insurance Task Force, and I'm a parent of a young man with severe autism. And you'll hear several people talk about the importance of licensure in regards to billing and our ability to retain those professionals in the state. So I'm not going to cover those topics because I know others will. But for my piece, what I'd like to talk about is really the importance of licensure in terms of quality control of professionals for families. So very quickly, families who have children with autism are often desperate for services, and with so few options available in Alaska, they will take whatever they can get, basically. And if the service is of poor quality, they really have nowhere to go to talk about that concern or to investigate a concern, even though there is that national piece. A local licensure would certainly offer a level of quality control for those professionals. And rural communities with limited access to professionals are at risk of receiving services from practitioners who are not providing quality and safe services, because rural communities tend to be isolated from other professionals that would recognize these issues early. Behavior analysts working in those communities and who do not have adequate skills may continue to provide inadequate or unsafe services. The licensure process would certainly provide some venue for addressing those issues. And lastly, families living in rural communities are often even more desperate for any type of service, and they will take whatever is available. So this can lead them to accept low-quality services, which can create more challenges than what may have existed before services were provided. Licensure provides a foundation of minimum quality across the profession and in all communities. It also puts in place a system for families and professionals to address ethical concerns and other issues related to service provision. These are critical concerns for children with autism and individuals with challenging behaviors. Licensure would help to address these concerns.
Thank you, ma'am.
And thank you so much. Are there any questions?
Seeing none, thank you, ma'am. Rachel White.
I'm Dr. Rachel White. I am the owner of Good Behavior Beginnings, and I am a board-certified behavior analyst at the doctorate level. My company provides in-home ABA services to children with autism, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of this bill. I believe that this will help provide access to services for those families whose insurance company requires a state licensed provider to provide coverage. Currently, I have encountered several families that have approached me looking for services, and their insurance company will not cover any services by behavior analysts because there is no state license. So I think a state license will help provide access for those families to then get the services that their children need. The other piece that Dr. Keith O'Donnell mentioned as well is that we do have a national board that oversees us, and we can take ethical concerns, grievances to them. So as far as having the professional license without the regulatory board, there is a mechanism in place for individuals to take concerns about practicing behavior analysts. And so I'm here testifying in support, and I am available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. White. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. White. Lori Unum?
My name is Lori Unum, and I am pleased to testify in strong support of House Bill 361. I come to you in various capacities today. I am Vice President of State Government Affairs at the national nonprofit Autism Speaks, and in that capacity, I had the pleasure of working with many of you on Senate Bill 74 a few years ago when we were passing the legislation to get insurance coverage for children with autism and for ABA therapy in particular. I'm also a professor at George Washington University Law School, where I teach a course called Autism and the Law. I'm a founder in my home state of South Carolina of an ABA center that serves children with autism. And most importantly, I'm also a mom of a son with autism. So I come at this from various perspectives, and I guess I want to offer sort of a national perspective on licensure of behavior analysts. It definitely is a trend that we see taking off, in part driven by the insurance legislation that has now passed in 35 states, including Alaska, as I mentioned. At present, 15 states have created some kind of licensure or state certification for behavior analysts. And you may recall, or some of you in the audience maybe, will think this is inconsistent with what I said a few weeks ago in the hearing. A few weeks ago when I testified on this bill, it was only 14 states. But since that time, Alabama has passed legislation, and it's been signed by the governor, also creating licensure for behavior analysts. And if I testify again next week, I think it's going to be 16, because Maryland just yesterday passed some legislation as well, which I believe the governor there is planning to sign. So it definitely is the way that states are moving to ensure consumer protection in the autism ABA therapy world. Just a couple of words about your bill. I've studied these bills all over the country, and I think HB 361 is a very sound bill, well-drafted. Some states have created new boards. Others have put licensure under existing boards. I think it can work just fine either way. Your bill does rely on the existing national certification, as some other witnesses have testified, which we are in full support of. It's a very strong credential that has been examined by the insurance companies all over, and they approve of that credential, so there's no need to reinvent the wheel where a good, solid certification already exists. Your bill does also include a disciplinary mechanism, although I agree with prior speakers who have said that the National Behavior Analyst Certification Board disciplinary mechanism is a real enforcement piece, and I have seen people lose their certification or be otherwise reprimanded under that board's disciplinary mechanism. Your bill also creates appropriate exemptions for people who should not have to be licensed. It creates temporary license for people who are transferring from other states. So all in all, I'll try to keep it short since you ask us to do so, but I think this is a good bill, and Autism Speaks is pleased to support it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, ma'am. And we see none, and I will note that she is calling in from South Carolina, just an indication of Representative Sadler's outreach. Suzanne Letso.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Letso. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst and the CEO of the Alaska Center for Autism and the Connecticut Center for Child Development. In addition, I'm also a member of the Board of Directors for the Behavior Analyst Certification Board and may be able to answer some of your questions about funding and so forth for running a licensure. First, I would like to, I have four documents that I included with my written testimony. One is a budget that was done for Kentucky. The net, I believe, is roughly $7,000, including running their own disciplinary board. But I think an option could potentially be to sort of kick the can down the road on running disciplinary processes through Alaska by temporarily deferring to the Behavior Analyst Certification Board disciplinary process unless and until either an appropriation is made or sufficient revenue from fees from behavior analysts are accumulated to take that piece on yourself. That might be a sort of a nice way to segue into having it be in-state if that's the preference. I think the cost of running a licensing program can be very small because of what the BACB can do in terms of absorbing most of those costs. I also think that the state stands to save a fair amount of money in a couple of ways. One would be because they would be able to bring kids back into state that are currently only able to be served out of state. Secondly, as part of my testimony, I submitted two cost-benefit analyses. One was in Texas, which determined that on a per-student basis, by providing intensive ABA, they saved approximately $208,000 per student over the, I think it's 17 years that kids would be in special education, or 18 years. The second was a cost-benefit analysis done by Jacobson, Mulick, and Green, and they looked at it from a lifespan approach, and they came up with anywhere between $200,000 and $600,000 in savings. And the fourth document that I provided is simply a slide that I created regarding finances here in Connecticut. I looked at the cost of providing ABA services in district and out of district placements, which is really very common here in Connecticut, and the cost of just providing adult day service programs for people with disabilities for approximately 60 years, which is roughly how long this population would be expected to be alive. If you look only at adult day programs and the most minimal kinds of benefits of receiving early intensive intervention, and when I say that, I mean things like being able to be toilet trained, being able to continue to live at home rather than require an expensive residential placement, being able to be staffed with a one-to-one support person only half a day. So these are the absolutely most, like, almost abysmal outcomes that you could look for that show any kind of positive gain, and it still nets out almost $200,000 in savings to the state. If you add to that what can be saved by the state if children can remain at home for 25 years, and in Connecticut, and I think this is very similar around the country, most of the time, these individuals will stay at home with their parents until their parents are roughly 75 years of age or one of the parents dies. If you look at the cost savings for being able to keep kids with their families until their parents pass away, you're looking at between $3 and $4 million per person. So there's a lot of different ways this can sound very positive.
Ms. Letso, we do have your letter in the packet. If we could just have you wrap up, please.
I'm done.
you don't have to be done immediately if you had some notes that you wanted to make sure you got.
No, that was really my ending point, other than to make myself available for questions.
Okay, thank you. And she is from the Alaska Center for Autism, for members. Any questions for Ms. Letso? Thank you, Ms. Letso. Do we have any more people off net or in the LIOs? Is there anybody in the audience? Hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed. Bring it back to the committee. Any committee questions? Representative Wilson?
Mr. Chairman, I thought we were going to hear from the department so we could have the understanding of the difference between the board yesterday that was being presented and this one.
Well, on that note, I'd like to ask Ms. Sarah Chambers to come up, the director.
Thank you.
Off license.
That's what I thought you were going to do.
She's getting used to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as Representative Sadler presented to us that this was going to be a different type of board that we heard yesterday, and our concerns primarily of can a board this small be able to absorb some of the costs that we have heard in the past from others. And I guess the other part of the question would be, as we heard from one of the testifiers, is there another board, instead of creating one, that they could go into and still accomplish the same goals?
Thank you. Representative Wilson, through the chair, these are excellent questions, and many of them will mirror the testimony I provided yesterday. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the director of the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing. And there are, as you know, many variables that go into licensing. The centralized licensing statutes and regulations do require that all of the professions, whether there is a board or not, to be investigated or require investigation when a complaint is made by the public or when other red flags are raised through our processes regarding licensees or unlicensed practice. So regardless of how a licensing program is organized with or without a board, there are still, I'd like to say, they're still on the hook for investigations. In looking at, in a response to our discussion yesterday, in the desire to provide additional detailed information to this body, in particular in response to Representative Munoz's questions yesterday, I did do a little bit of analysis on potential cost to behavior analysts if they are licensed, and my estimate, again, knowing that investigations are variable and are really driven by the public, would be fairly minimal. They would, I'm estimating just perhaps a couple of $1,000s a year for investigative cost, knowing that there are investigations that are triggered also by license applications, where there are potentially requirements for licensees to provide certain information and disclose certain information. We do pass those through investigation when there are questions. So the question about the number of licensees, knowing that that is a strong driver of cost, the initial biennium program estimates, which would include startup costs, that would be a one-time higher cost factor to this board, look, or this program, looking at a 25-person program, which were the numbers that we were initially provided, versus a 42-person program, which the testifier mentioned. There were several in the pipeline. I believe Representative Sadler has also testified to that effect. Could see a initial biennium cost of anywhere between $700 and $1,200 for licensure, and then that number dramatically decrease after those one-time setup cost would be paid for with that first biennium fee, again, in keeping with the requirements of AS0801065 that all licensing costs must be borne by the licensee. So looking at a 25 or 42 person licensing program in the out years could be anywhere from $400 to $600. And again, my estimates are erring on the more expensive, because I would rather be in front of you saying it could be rather high than to say this is going to be a very minimal cost and then come back a few years later with a very different story for you.
I just have one follow-up, and I'm not too sure who can answer the question. But it is my understanding that one reason for this board to be certified is because most insurances at this point are not covering this therapy. And so is that the biggest driver, is so that now insurance will be able to pay because now we have some kind of a board certification? And probably Representative Sadler's.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I want to correct him. Perhaps this is not a board. This is not a professional licensing board model. It's a departmental licensing. But in terms of your specific question, there are benefits to the public and to the providers, and frankly, the families too, by having licensed providers, which would be subject to reimbursement from private insurance at a higher rate. That's correct.
Thank you.
And I'm sure I answered exactly the question you asked, but I want to get that out there.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
So I'm just trying to really connect it to a bill that we passed a few years ago that had to do with had to do with private insurance paying, and we received some calls in our office about then once they, because this therapy wasn't recognized in the state of Alaska, there were then issues, not just most issues for paying. It ended up being to where I, as the parent, would have to pay because my insurance wouldn't. And I'm just trying to figure out, is that really what's, and it's fine if it is, I'm just trying to understand, is that what's really driving to doing what you're doing, and then you pick this way of going because it's probably less expensive for those versus a full-fledged board and all the members. So I'm just trying to connect the dots.
That's correct. Yes, to the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct. There are some BCBAs who have had those challenges with billing for their services in Alaska, and one of the recommendations drawing on national experience, one of the recommendations was that if BCBAs did have licensure in the state, that would place them in a more easily identifiable category relative to the private health insurance, and they would be able to assign CPT codes and say, oh, yes, this is a licensed provider. Here's how we provide them. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's good discussion on the indirect cost also. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Representative Sadler, I appreciated you pointing out that this is not creating a board because that's where it gets expensive when you have a board traveling to quarterly or annual meetings and things. Also, there was one letter in the packet from Premier of Blue Cross, and they had a suggestion in there that they would like to have seen added to the bill. And it basically said, and is practicing within the scope of the licensure or specialty standards. Is that something that you reviewed?
To the chair, Representative Thompson, I hadn't dealt with that real thoroughly. I'd be willing to take as the largest insurance management company in the state, if that's something they thought would be appropriate, that as long as people were practicing within the scope of their practice to be covered, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, I'm not a legal beagle, if you want to call it that, but I felt like this was something that they might require before that they would honor an insurance claim.
To the chair, Representative Thompson, I believe we do have letters from Premier indicating they do support the approach of this bill.
Yes, they
and they like to just
do the chair. Yes, the they do support it, and that they ask that we suggest the following language be added. So,
yeah.
Maybe you can continue to work on that one with that group, Representative Sadler, and figure out what we need to do there.
That's not objectionable at all.
Representative Stoltz?
Yeah, I'd like to, I don't like to do an amendment on the fly, but if we can shoot for a target of, we're going to try to have some evening meetings next week to catch up. We have a lot of hanging bills that we have been doing work on, and if we can get this to be one of those, and we'll leave the responsibility of you to communicate to our members as well.
Yep.
So, as we're tied up with a lot of other things.
I will have to take that on.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think I need a little clarification on something you said. There's no board here, right? So we're not creating a board. We're creating a recognizing a level of license. But you said investigations, people who are being investigated under this licensing section, those investigative charges would be charged back or be added onto the license costs, even though there's not a board?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, AS0801065 requires that all costs that are attributable to a particular licensing program, whether there's a board or not, are paid for by the licensees. We have 20 boards and commissions and 19 programs that are licensed that do not have boards and commissions. The real difference between the two is that a board or commission has the governance power to really dig into the scope of practice and practice policies that really protect the public within the scope of activity of that license. The more administrative activities, whether it's opening the mail at the front desk and receiving funding, issuing licenses, performing investigations, those are all departmental requirements. So those do not change whether there's a board or not. However, a board has a significant role in driving the level of investigation, whether they, within the scope of the sort of sentencing guidelines that they have access to through the law.
So board, where there is a board, they have a strong role in driving investigative activity, either pushing it or pulling it back. But the investigative activity where it occurs is a licensing cost and by law must be borne by the licensees. This was an element that we brought up earlier in the session with HB 187 and will be an interim discussion that we hope to have with members of the legislature so we can continue to address some of those concerns.
And just to follow, but that doesn't include criminal prosecutions.
It's just through the chair, Representative Gunberg, that's correct. We do not have criminal authority. We have civil authority as the scope of licensure investigation. Yesterday, I mentioned an example with the massage therapy bill where there may be a prostitution investigation. That would not be under our purview, but under public safety or municipal law enforcement. However, where there is a conviction in that area, it may have a domino effect on their license. And I believe some of the testifiers from the national board mentioned that there is a strong opportunity for the national board to have a hand in affecting the level of level of investigation on licensure, particularly because this bill leans so heavily on that certification. So if someone's certification was revoked by that board, there would be no cost to the licensees because it's happening outside of Alaska law, but the domino effect would be that we would then have the opportunity to discipline or revoke the license as required by law.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I just wanted to put on the record that this is, I think, a very important issue that we've been speaking about here. For the licensed person to basically be punished by having an increase in their license cost for having the state of Alaska go after somebody that is misbehaving or practicing outside of their scope, that's a responsibility of the state of Alaska for the public safety and for the public good. And to punish those good doers with this, I think, is wrong, and I think that'll have to be addressed in the future like you're speaking of. I almost wanted to make that, put it on record.
I think absolutely, certainly come under additional scrutiny in this committee. Any further questions from either the director or the sponsor of the bill? And with that, I believe we had some questions that we wanted to return back on. Is that right, Mr. Chair?
I didn't listen to all of it, but we'll work out the fiscal notes. They look like they have mostly great, you know. I guess from our discussions, we'll put it in the terms of green lights. There is just in our discussion with Ledge Finance, just one question of the overall cost, but that's an uncertainty when you do anything new in government. And that's an appropriate caution on any legislation. So it's good to hear autism speak again, because that's I love that phrase, because it's been a silent and misunderstood subject matter which affects so many of us, and getting it. Getting it out of the cloud of misunderstanding. I appreciate your efforts in that, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And again, this committee's full support of the Collaborative Behavioral Health Program, too, to help autism patients.
And that's been noted. We appreciate that very much. They're going to be complementary. They will help each other.
Mr. Vice Chair, whatever jurisdiction I have, I sure hope we get this back soon before us.
I believe you have full jurisdiction over there. So I believe with that note, was there any further questions from the committee? Thank you, Representative Sadler.
I look forward to coming back to you with the amendment language addressed, and thank you for your time.
Thanks, sir. Thank you. Work with Mr. George, please.
We'll do it quickly. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. At ease.
committee back into order. Thank you. In front of us, we have Committee Substitute for Health Resolution 89, version backslash C. I believe this has been up before. So, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the rest of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present the HB 89. It's on rapid response to aquatic invasive species. And, you know, we're looking across Alaska at an important threat to our aquatic environment. We've got Alodia, which has been in Sand Lake in the Anchorage area. We have it on the Kenai Peninsula. We have it in Fairbanks in the Chinas Slough. The importance of this is that it overruns salmon habitat. It also overruns Arctic grayling habitat, diminishes the capacity. The big problem is that as these invasive species get established, they're almost impossible to eradicate, and then we're into a element of control with pike. We have seen that in parts of South Central. We have Devex, which is a colonial tunicate out of Sitka. I think that that one, which smothers all of the substrate and also could very definitely impact fisheries, whether those are commercial or sport fisheries. We have things like hard shell clams that would impact, as well as they could close the herring fishery. And we have threats that are potentially coming up the West Coast in green crab and quahog and zebra mussels, which have cost, you know, I think we've had about $120 billion worth of damages per year in the United States to do this. And within Alaska, we spent $28 million since 2007 through Alaska government and non-governmental agencies trying to limit the expansion of some of these invasive species. So the whole idea of this bill is to get out ahead and to have a plan in place to quickly address an incipient population. That incipient population meaning a new population that is growing in a limited area before it becomes established. And our problem has been that we don't have plans in place for taking care of that that overrides some other concerns, so it takes a long time. It's been like 4 years getting a handle on a program to actually work on eradicating DVEX in Sitka, and we've been very lucky that that has been a slowly expanding invasive species instead of a rapidly expanding one. So that's what we're trying to do in this bill. We're giving state or agencies not only authority to act, but the responsibility to coordinate and to prioritize actions. It establishes a response fund. There's no money put into that fund, but there is a limitation on the fund that the fund can't be used for planning. It could only be used for responses. There's also been consideration for private property and in development of plans that private property holders, other groups would also work with DNR, DEC, and ADF&G in the construction of the plans. And so that's this where that would take place. And this also gives the priority for a localized area that addressing a incipient population would take priority over other ongoing things, such as we had a problem in the Sitka area where you had an aquatic farm, and the question was what happens with the private property or impacts on that. And this also holds the state harmless in cases where they are responding under a plan for control of a invasive species. And it also, like I say, that hold harmless is there only if they're exercising in a plan. And Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Stiltz.
Just one quick question. I guess to share something, the Mat-Su Fishing Game, Mat-Su Borough Fishing Game Advisory Committee has endorsed this legislation as important as an important step. You recognize them as a credible group, Representative Seaton?
Well, I do, and also we have one from the Wasilla Soil and Water Conservation District, as well as other conservation districts. Anyway, you have a lot of letters in your packet, I believe.
I just want to, on the Matsu Fish and Game Advisory Commission, we have at least two career biologists on there, Mr. Dilo and Mr. Engel, who both served on the Board of Fish. Even though not everybody has spoken favorably about Mr. Dilo or has even voted for him as a qualified professional, and one of the Matsu Borough delegation does, and that's one area we have a difference of opinion with you from past experience. And they also have some very well-formulated positions on other fisheries issues because of their expertise, and I hope that they're listened to as widely and respected as you've acknowledged they are in the future. That's all I'd
like to know, too, that they're both statewide biologists, the whole career around the whole state of Alaska with all the different fisheries engaged.
There has been, through this building, when the Kenai Peninsula delegation kind of did an onslaught, there were some very personalized attacks against the Matsu Fish and Game Advisory Commission, some name-calling, and some very ugly rhetoric, and I just wanted to take this advantage to take this opportunity although we were very underrepresented by population and certainly by user group and every other faction, it was really a sideshow, and I was very disgusted by how the Matsu Fish and Game Advisory Committee was treated. I wanted to take this opportunity to help set the record straight, and that's all I had, Mr. This is a bill I support, and I try to be consistent on my application. When I recognize somebody as an expert, I don't trash them the next day.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Representative Costello?
Thank you, and I would like it on the record that this legislation does not direct any specific method of eradication, but that it allows the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and the communities to make the decision about how to go about the eradication. So does this direct the eradication method?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, no, it does not. It is a planning document so that all of the agencies and the private parties, such as Soil and Water Conservation Districts, would be at the table in deciding on eradication methods that would be in a plan that could be then implemented. So there is no specification for a certain plan. It's going to depend on the area, it's going to depend on the species, but getting a plan ahead of time is what will allow rapid response. And if we don't have rapid response, then we're just in control mode forever and very costly to the state.
Thank you.
And Representative Costello certainly knows about a little bit about that in her community and working with her community. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question on the private property issue. So I understand that Fish and Game can come and take care of the invasive species, like in the Chena, which there was two articles just in the paper about the good work they're doing. But I didn't understand the portion if something happens and if something's destroyed on private property, that's kind of too bad because they were there for a different reason. So I wasn't sure what we were doing there.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. No, what this is really addressing is the areas like down in Whiting Harbor in Sitka, there was an aquatic farm there. And so we had a year delay while Fish and Game was figuring out, well, could they be sued because this stuff was on aquatic farm nets, that if we went in and destroyed it while it was still localized, would we be responsible for the people's aquatic farm and for any lost shellfish there? And so what this does is requires DNR in future permits to put in a provision that the person that's getting a permit for an aquatic farm recognizes if they get an invasive species in their gear, the state can come in and control that before it escapes and becomes generally established. And the state is not responsible for loss in their farm. And so that would be something that would be put right in their permit so they would know up front that that's not going to be there. And so so let us say that you had somebody that had a Lodia outbreak, and you came in and you were using a method that, let's say you drained a small lake, that somebody said, oh, I like to go out there and fish, you know, in a localized area, you're not going to, and say, oh, well, that harmed me because my dock was there and now it's not in the water for that short length of time. That would be where we would prevent lawsuits against the state for any interactions. But these plans would all have to be developed ahead of time. And so the public and the soil and water conservation districts and all would be at the table when the plans are being developed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I was right with him for a minute, but now I'm not. Okay, so I have a private lake on my own private property. Can Fish and Game come in, or DNR, and drain my lake because they think there's something in it that shouldn't be? I mean, I was fine with you on a permit in the waterway, and that was in their permit here, because I like legislation, so I don't want anybody to think that, yeah, I want you to take the invasive. But I want to make sure that on people's private property, like a lake or some kind of water that they put in, that what you just said couldn't happen to that private property owner, or that they can even be on private property without permission from the landowner to take care of whatever they are. That's the part I'm looking at. If it's a permit for a certain thing going on in the waters and it's in that permit, I have no problems with that. But I'm trying to figure out whether or not this also gives permission to be, like you just said, draining a lake on private property, because what they want to do is more important than what maybe the landowner understands.
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think the department's here and they can testify on exactly what I wasn't talking about on private property, but an invasive species, if it's in a lake like Sand Lake. Sand Lake is not a good example. Daniels or Stormy, Elodia down on the Kenai Peninsula would be a much better example, where people might have docks and they want to say, well, you're going to ruin my view for this while you have this thing out there, either mechanically taking a loadie out or something else. Whatever that plan is that they implement, the consequence of not doing that could be multi-millions of dollars, and it could be very significant impact on salmon habitat. And so, but I'd let you to ask the departments as to how they view that hold harmless.
I just want to make sure on the record that we are not invading people's private properties to say we know better, and then if they destroy something, it doesn't become the state's problem.
That's a good question. And if it is private property, how those weeds can be spread? Can it be spread by waterfowl, ducks, planes, a variety of things? And so we've got the departments here. We do have some folks that are waiting to testify in the off-net, so I'd like to give them the courtesy to do that. We need to close down by 10 here today, so if we can go to public testimony, I'd appreciate that, and then we'll come back to the committee. Let's start with off-net. Gina Gazzino from Anchorage.
Hi, yeah, this is Gino Graziano from Anchorage. I'm representing the Alaska Committee for Noxious Invasive Plant Management. I work with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Cooperative Extension Services, and an invasive plants instructor providing education to professionals and the public about invasive species issues. And I wanted to thank the committee for hearing this bill and the opportunity for us to comment. Your all continued attention to invasive species issues is really exemplary. These bills really provide an understanding that legislation is necessary to really ensure the state has a long-term commitment to these invasive species issues. It is really good that the House bill will establish a plan for aquatic invasive species management and push the state agencies to cooperate together and make a priority to develop these plans as these issues arise. I also appreciate that the bill has language in there to get the group to utilize methods of least harm, and also does address resources that are on private property, in indicating that the agencies will work with the private landowners. And establishing a fund is also a great step forward. In the past, the state passed studies by the Institute of Social and Economic Research The state has been shown to not necessarily put forth as much funds towards invasive species management as other entities. I believe it was about 5% in a year from 2007 to 2011. And state funds can be really pivotal in helping secure more federal funding and also in really expediting these eradications that we need to get done before it becomes too expensive to take care of them, and we have to sustain resource losses as well as continued expenses. So to conclude, the Alaska Committee for Noxious Invasive Plant Management supports the passage of this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to comment and continuing to hear this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Gaziano. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Marcus Mueller, and then we'll go to the Fairbanks LIO after that. Mr. Mueller.
Thank you for considering House Bill 89, providing leadership on aquatic invasives. This bill is very timely and will be increasingly important for Alaska. Good morning from the Kenai Peninsula. This is Marcus Mueller. I'm the land management officer for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. I'd also like to pass along a good morning from Mayor Navarre's office and Mr. Ostrander. As you know, aquatic invasives, whether they're foreign plants, foreign fish, or other organisms, they have the potential to significantly disrupt systems that Alaskans rely on. And they present broad economic threats and threats to our natural resources. House Bill 89 is a bill that protects our natural resources, particularly the rapid response element is of particular significance. Rapid response provides the best chance of providing an effective way to deal with biological invasives. Acting quickly minimizes impacts and increases overall odds for either containment or eradication. This is definitely a situation where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as we know that cure can get very costly, as Mr. Graziano said. Planning aspects are included in this bill, which are critical. This bill appropriately and responsibly calls for planning and coordination, and that is a very important and well-supported aspect of this bill. In the Kenai Peninsula Borough, we are seeing examples of how aquatic invasives can impact us. We are seeing also the value of rapid response. We've seen this with northern pike, Elodia, reed canary grass. The Elodia issue on the Kenai Peninsula is currently being addressed through a cooperative effort. Department of Fish and Game is really taking the lead. We have the borough is involved. Department of Natural Resources is heavily involved, and the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. Elodia has been identified as affecting Stormy Lake, Daniels Lake, and Back Lake. As you can imagine, residents are taking this very seriously. Lakeshore owners want to protect their lakes, just as we would assume that mariculture growers would want to protect their businesses. House Bill 344 is also looking at another aspect of aquatic invasives with prohibiting the sale of Elodia. And so as we can see, the effects of dealing with aquatic invasives is right in front of us, and this is very timely. And Elodia definitely provides a nice case study of how the aspects of this bill can be implemented in a really smart and strategic way. When we look at the big picture of aquatic invasives, we see the pattern of detection, spread, degradation of a system, loss of native species, and other resources, and the variety of human responses from changing techniques to the loss of opportunities to utilize previously abundant resources. We can look back and see that the front line from an economic development standpoint is at the very beginning of the cycle, that early detection and rapid response. This is the same concept that our firefighters use. This bill is important to the Kenai Peninsula in protecting both our coastal waters and our inland waters. We thank you for considering House Bill 89. This is, as previously noted, a fiscally responsible approach to protecting Alaska resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Do we have any other off-net? Hearing none, go to Fairbanks LIO. Joni Scharnberg, followed by Adani Shine.
Hello, this is Joni Scharnberg. I'm the district coordinator for the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm speaking for them, who represents over 400 private landowner households. I'm also speaking for the Chena Slough Neighborhood and Technical Committees here in the Fairbanks area. And I urge you to pass House Bill 89. We do have a lot of private landowner support, and especially along the Chena Slough, those landowners have been negatively impacted by the growth and spread of the invasive Elodea. As a lead entity in gathering the info and coordinating partners' efforts to find a solution to the aquatic invasive Elodea infestation in Chena Slough, Chena Lakes, and Chena River, and other places in interior Alaska and statewide, we believe it is important for the state of Alaska to establish and fund a rapid response and management plan for addressing this invasive aquatic species. Worldwide, Elodea has impeded navigability of waters and lakes, makes recreational and sport subsistence and commercial fishery problematic or impossible, and can negatively impact salmon spawning habitats as well as other fish habitats, particularly in the interior here at Grayling. Since discovered about 3 years ago in Chena Slough in the interior, Elodea infestation has dramatically increased. In some areas in the slough, the plant is now several feet thick, and it makes control and eradication much more difficult. A rapid response management plan could have slowed this problem and needs to be in place immediately for these and new infestations of Elodea. If unchecked, Elodea could colonize more sloughs and oxbows of the Tanana and Yukon drainages and be spread by floatplains and lakes further across the state. In addition, over $100,000 of private and federal funds have been spent in the study and eradication efforts of Elodea already in the state and interior. And if the state of Alaska passes HB 89, I believe more cost share would be available to help work on this problem. Please don't delay in passing HB 89, which is so important to Alaska's waterways and fish habitat and sport fishery. And thanks so much for being proactive with the passage of this bill.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions? Representative Wilson.
I just want to say thank you to Joni and all her efforts. She does a wonderful job in Fairbanks, and I just wanted to get the one question answered on the private property. We know we can get that in Fish and Game, so we are very supportive of the bill, or at least I'm very supportive. I want to speak to others.
Thank you. And Representative Thompson and Guttenberg are also shaking their heads, I think, in saying thank you for the Fairbanks Soil and Water Commission for what they do. Aditi Shinoy.
Hi, my name is Aditi Shinoy. I'm the invasive species specialist at Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District. Thanks for this opportunity to testify. So a large part of my job is working on taking steps to control Elodea and Chena Slough, and other folks have already started these efforts in the past couple of years. So on behalf of Fairbanks Soil and Water and Fairbanks Cooperative Weed Management Area, I'd like to strongly support the passage of House Bill 89. Like I said, an aquatic invasive of great concern in the interior is Elodea. It spreads really rapidly and grows aggressively in dense mats. And the presence of Elodea impacts stream flow and degrades spawning habitat, affecting important subsistence and sport fish species. It also creates impediments for safe operation of boats and floatplanes. I believe that if we do not act quickly to control the spread of Elodea during this early stage of its invasion, it could spread to major waterways such as the Tanana and the Yukon rivers and to other parts of Alaska via floatplanes, boats, and human and animal movement. I strongly encourage the passage of this bill, as I think that rapid response and early intervention to control invasive aquatics is essential to protecting Alaska's fisheries and recreational resources. And I think this bill is a step in the right direction. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none, is there anybody else in the Fairbanks LIO or other LIOs across the state? Hearing none, is there anybody in the audience? Hearing and seeing none, we will temporarily close public testimony for now. There may be more on this bill. It seems to be widespread support across the state, but we don't know. So when we bring it back, we'll just temporarily close public testimony. Come back to the committee. Do we have any further questions for the sponsor before we bring up the department? Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, just briefly.
Representative,
yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to thank Representative Seaton for always having a comprehensive packet behind his bills when he comes here, and I just think you or your staff have been very well prepared, so appreciate it.
He knows the system, not a good at it. Thank you. I'd like to have the director of Sportfish, Charlie Swanton, come out. And we also have questions if people have for the Department of Environment and Conservation, Division of Agriculture, and DNR. Mr. Phobos. Hi, Charlie. You know the procedure.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Charlie Swanton. I'm the director for the Division of Sportfish for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that and put on record that we're not talking about trumping any private property owners, that we're going to work with them, but at the end of the day, it is still private property.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, yeah, your assessment is exactly correct. We will be working with, you know, with folks depending upon the situation, depending upon, you know, what species and those sorts of things with private property owners, not just, you know, taking into consideration what the treatment methods, so on and so forth, what the species is, risk, and those sorts of things. So private property owners will be consulted heavily with regards to, you know, whatever species and when.
Well, Mr. Chairman, he's almost there, but not quite, because that's what my concern is. In the sponsor statement, it says specifies that affected property, private property owners shall be considered, but still allows responding agencies to be held harmless for damages caused by their invasive species treatment. I guess I'm looking for more than just that they'll be considered, but that, you know, we still take into account that it is, you know, and I know we may be talking about two different things of businesses being in the water, doing specific things in the water versus we don't have that, from what I know, in the interior, and going across somebody's private property and demanding that they have to participate in this even though they've been quote-unquote considered.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, you know, I sat and listened, and I was looking for a, you know, a crystal clear example with regards to how this would work. And, you know, Representative Seaton brought up some of the problems that we've had specifically with regards to the situation with tunicates in Whiting Harbor. And, you know, that was kind of a unique situation because the tunicates were actually attached to anchor line ropes, you know. And I think that's what Representative Seaton was trying to address with this, you know, in that when it comes time to, you know, I mean, in those cases, the means to remove the threat was to actually physically take all of that, the docks, the running lines, the anchors, and that sort of stuff, completely out of the water. And it took us some time to, you know, contact the owner of the property and get permission to turn around and say, yeah, it's the right thing to do. And, you know, those sorts of consultations will take place, but it's difficult to address, you know, access and, you know, whether it be real property or whether it be, you know, land and those sorts of things, which, you know, my counterpart sitting behind me with DNR is probably a lot more schooled with regards to those sorts of things in terms of access. And, but, you know, it's not like it's just going to be marching forward without taking any consideration and consultation with a private property owner, depending upon what the situation is. Mr. Chairman.
Maybe it's just me and my experiences with agencies, and I know sometimes they consult, and at the end of the day, they feel like they can still do it because they've done the consultation. And I don't know whether it's your plan, Mr. Chairman, to move this bill today or whether we have some time to ask, because I think what I'm asking is very different than what Representative Seaton's trying to put in the bill on something like that. That would be, I can understand where you're coming from on your example, but I guess I just don't feel like just consulting property owners is private property owners is enough to be able to say we considered it and then we went ahead and did what we wanted to do. So I'm not going to stop the bill from moving because I think I get my questions answered anyway. I don't know what the plan here is, but I'm still very concerned about the way it's stated here.
It's not the plan to move this bill out today. There's some questions we need to resolve on the fiscal notes and stuff like that. It was brought up in public testimony about how the fund's going to work and some of those. And I'd like to probably see a little bit more of committee members be able to ask different questions. And maybe, Charlie, if you could maybe you and your staff or work with Ed to see if you could come up with, to give some scenarios on what we might try and see or envision how this would work with different types of, if land, if there's a lake on public property, and to address some of the questions so that we can get more of a visual on what we're doing here. I think we'll be more comfortable that way. Representative Gary has a question, but I'd like to ask also, Charlie, how generally do these weeds get spread? I mean, is it going to be, I know you and I have talked a lot about floats on airplanes, of wildlife, of birds, ducks, and stuff that might waddle in the weeds and go into other areas. Generally, how do they get spread? Boat trailers, boats.
Mr. Chairman, you know, it depends on the species and the location, but, you know, pretty much what you just cataloged are, you know, are potential or, you know, real vectors for, you know, the spread of Elodia. I mean, and depending upon, you know, what other species, you know, those are some of the, you know, those are some of the transmission vectors. That's how they get around. So I don't know how much, you know, beyond that.
Could the same be said for, like, pike,
yeah,
eggs and stuff?
Mr. Chairman, it seems like Fridays are my lucky day with regards to these sorts of things, because that same question came up from Senator Bishop on last Friday, and with regards to pike eggs, you know, it depends on the time of the year and, you know, what species of bird or whatever else. It certainly has the potential. I just don't know what the probability of that is. I mean, pike eggs are adhesive when they're first laid. They're in shallow water. You know, birds do feed on, you know, eggs when they're in shallow water, those sorts of things. So it's possible, but I just don't have any way to quantify. I mean, you know, I'm sure that, you know, there's all kinds of vectors out there. Some present more of a risk than others, and, you know, I don't have the, you know, the real hard facts on what the probability of, you know, of a duck carrying, you know, pike eggs to another lake would be, Mr. Chairman.
That's something Charlie and I have talked days on. But, you know, obviously they're waddling around in creeks and streams and like that and preening. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look at page 2 of the bill, we certainly all want to make sure we minimize any damage to non-invasive fish populations. But the way it reads is, the department shall respond, so they have to respond, in a manner determined to cause the least harm to non-invasive fish populations. And I can imagine a circumstance where there's only two approaches. One is super, super harmful, and one is pretty harmful to non-invasive fish populations. And it seems under this language, you would have to pick the pretty harmful one. That you don't have the discretion not to respond. And that's just something I'd like to fix, to give the option to not respond if the damage to the fish population is greater than the damage caused by the non-invasive plant species. But do you agree that on page 2, line 22, you have to respond with the least harmful response possible, but if one is harmful and one is much more harmful, you still have to pick the harmful one? Or would you just not act? It just seems like it says you shall. I have an easy fix for it, but
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, you know, in its totality, you know, the department shall respond in a manner determined to cause the least harm to non-invasive fish populations. So, you know, interpretation of that to me is that, you know, if you have a suite of responses, that it'd be incumbent upon the department and or multiple departments in terms of moving forward that we would look for the least harmful approach. And that's how we would proceed, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I imagine with the herbicides, the DEC, and all the above. Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I totally understand you have to pick the least harmful one, but what if there is no really non-harmful one and you've got to choose between one that's super, super harmful and the only other one is pretty harmful? And I just would have some worry that's the least harmful one, but it's still pretty harmful, and you'd still have to act. And I'd like to give you the discretion not to act if the benefit by preventing the invasive species is dwarfed by the harm to the fishery.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, that sounds reasonable to me.
I'll try and work with the sponsor just to be satisfied on that point.
Thank you. And just members, you know, again, herbicides, mechanical means, there's a lot of different ways that eradication of these invasive species can happen. Volunteers helping out. We're going to have to postpone the meeting for now and bring it back up again in front of the committee. So you can always ask Representative Seaton or send questions to the chair that we can get out for the whole committee that we can direct towards the different divisions. Thank you. And with that, we will end today's meeting.